Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Executive Function Online Summit. My name is Seth Perler, and I'm here today with Angela Pruis. I'm going to read some notes a little bit here and introduce her. She's an LMFT, licensed marriage and family therapist out of Wisconsin, and she has a website called parentswithconfidence.com. And her background's in child psychology, child development, play therapy, and child mental health. And right now, I believe, and she'll clarify everything for us, she's a special needs parent coach. And one of the things that she specializes in is parenting for what she calls invisible disabilities. And I have a phrase that I talk about a lot with invisibility, so I'm interested to get into that with her. And she helps families with children who have ADHD, anxiety, sensory processing disorder, giftedness, learning disabilities, high-functioning Asperger's, et cetera, et cetera. And let's see, she works with intense kids. She's a mother of three kids herself, two special needs kids. And her superpower is she loves helping unearth the gifts that kids have, their strengths, and she likes helping differently wired kids and helping families understand what's going on with differently wired kids. And I have so many more notes. I actually don't want to get, I want to get more into this with you in a moment. So as we get started here, what I want Angela to start off telling us real quick is what are we going to cover today? And she's got two major ideas that she's going to cover today, and then we'll get way deeper into her background. So Angela, what are we covering today?
Sure. So I hope today to talk about some really common behaviors that stem from executive functioning deficits that often parents have no clue, that these things are stemming from these invisible challenges. So I want to talk about some myths and some realities as far as some of the most common challenging behaviors that we see with our kiddos and why they're really happening and how that is really opposed to a lot of our assumptions as parents. So that is a big one. And then also, I hope to talk about really helping parents change their mindset as far as viewing these challenging behaviors. And then from there, finding that balance of how do we then, once we have the correct and helpful mindset, how do we help support our kids, and how do we specifically, how do we equip them and empower them and help them, but also still support them and kind of treading that water of helping them cope and helping them learn these skills, but then also not crippling them and not doing too much for them. So that is a really challenging thing for a lot of parents. And then finally, I want to talk about how some practical ways that parents can help bring out their child's strengths and some of the reasons why that's so challenging. That sounds kind of cliche and kind of surface level, but there are some actual brain-based reasons why as parents we really struggle focusing in on our child's strengths. So, why some of those things are, why our thought process is that way and how we can go about changing it, because that shift will totally change the game. For families' lives right now and for their child's life forever. So that is a biggie.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm so excited too, because that's what I want to parents to get out of these sessions, is I want these to be game changers where we can really shift, hopefully after this summit, like parents have gotten so much that they can really shift the game. And I really like how you're going to go into the difference between supporting and enabling, or learned helplessness, or things that are not supporting when we're trying to help and it's not helping. So let's do some background right now. So tell us just about you personally, not professionally, but a little bit personally for a moment.
Sure. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on. I am super happy to be here and grateful to hopefully reach lots of families through this awesome event. So thank you very much. So again, I'm Angela Pruis. I have been a child and family counselor now for 15 years somehow, and have been working with differently wired kiddos and absolutely loving it. a couple years back, I decided I wanted to try to reach parents a little bit more. And so I, and also, you know, have the flexibility of being at home with my kiddos, which is awesome too. So I started my website, Parents with Confidence. And there I write a lot about helping parents raise emotionally healthy kids who will not just survive out in the world someday and get by, but will thrive and live really full, you know, emotionally healthy, meaningful lives. So I write about all sorts of different things that lend themselves to a child's emotional health, like emotional intelligence, helping kids really understand their own emotions better, how to cope with them, how to understand the emotions of others, mindfulness, lots of different self-care things that promote good mental health, the importance of nature and play, and growth mindset, how do we teach our kids to be resilient and be able to persevere in the face of struggle, all those types of things that that raise really strong kids. So when I am not seeing kiddos in my private practice or writing, I am at home, like you said, with my three awesome kiddos. And as you mentioned, I have two completely awesome neurodiverse kiddos and one completely awesome neurotypical kiddo. And I am being a mom and at home with them. So I think that pretty much covers it.
Cool. And then what is your superpower? I know that I mentioned it, but what would you say, just off the cuff, what's your superpower as far as working particularly with kids who struggle with executive function?
Yes. So what I love is seeing the transformation in families that come into my office looking for therapy for their kids. They're frustrated. They're often in crisis, right? They're at the end of their rope and they come in and they're feeling pretty negative, pretty pessimistic. And really they are, as I'm sure many of the audience today is, and where I have been myself as well, is they're really stuck. They're stuck in this cycle of negativity. They're feeling powerless and frustrated and they, you know, ineffective. They don't know what to do and they don't know how to support their kids. And that negativity cycle, I call it the vortex of negativity. It really takes a toll. It takes a big toll on our kids. And so seeing the difference between how families come in and where they're at and how they're viewing their child. And then when, after they're able to get support and they're able to learn the why, you know, what's driving some of these behaviors, what challenges is my kiddo facing, then they're able to see things in a different way. And my superpower with this is really helping them shift their focus to the strengths, uncovering all these amazing things. And gosh, I can't tell you how many parents just really, it makes me feel emotional just thinking about it, because they really aren't able to sometimes even name a strength of their child when they're first coming in. And that is not conducive to a child who is going to have a strong sense of self and sense of, you know, self-esteem, and good intact mental health. So helping them to uncover their child's strengths and all of these amazing gifts. Every kid I've ever worked with, Seth, in my office, I'm telling you, kids I know personally, all of these kids are, they really are exceptional in their own ways, and they have these unique strengths and gifts, and they're just buried sometimes. They're buried in the day-to-day stress. And so helping to unearth those for parents and, you know, having them just shift and be able to see those on the other end is what I would say is my superpower.
I think that's so awesome, because I think it's almost like it's part of our culture to be so focused on challenges and perceived weaknesses and changing those things. And the reality is, and I'm so glad that you said that, is that when we're helping a child get what they need for life, what a happy, healthy, successful adult does is they build their life and their career around their strengths, not their weaknesses. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yet school oftentimes is so focused and culture oftentimes is so focused, but what they're going to build a future on, if they're really going to do it in a successful way where they feel great in life, is their strengths, their passions, their interests, their talents, their gifts, their unique things. And sometimes they're hidden, or they're not noticed, or they're not fostered or developed. So awesome. I love that. So what is the story behind why this matters to you? Why did you get into this in the first place? Like, there's one day and you're like, oh, I'm going to go in this direction with my life. Why do you care?
Yeah. You know, I've always loved working with kids, always. So I knew ever since I was young that I wanted to work with kids in some capacity. And then I think, you know, the field of mental health was intriguing to me. I loved learning about psychology. I loved learning about child psychology. That was my undergrad degree. And really that's just, I think, how I think and learn too, as far as just being kind of a, more of a bigger, you know, understanding the why and digging into the details a little bit. So that in combination with, you know, I love unique kids. I love supporting kids that are vulnerable, and that have a hard time, getting through the world. And of course, you know, it was these kids with these invisible challenges were near and dear to my heart, before I had my own. So then there was this massive crossover between, you know, work and life. And that really has been, a totally unexpected gift, because it really has allowed me to dial in to these issues at a really deep level and really be able to connect with families and parents, because I've walked this path, and it's not an easy one, and it definitely, it can be an awesome one when you have the right supports. It is an awesome one. So then, yeah, seeing my own kids and seeing the struggles, that they've experienced moving through the world, has been a huge eye opener, to see the discrepancy between, you know, what I know I have the luxury of knowing as a professional when I saw some of these challenges popping up for them, and other parents wouldn't know this, right? I mean, it would, so I was able to see things and notice things at an earlier degree, and to know, you know, the challenges that are happening beneath the surface, you know, beyond what we can see. And then seeing how the rest of the world receives them, seeing how their school receives them, seeing how, you know, our friends receive them, and really how these things that you can't see but are there are just so impactful and make such a big difference in how these kids go through the world. And they are, they're so amazing. And so it's very, every kid, I deeply believe every kid deserves to meet their full potential. And for some kids, it's much more difficult for them to do that, because, as you said, you know, their strengths, their gifts are being overshadowed sometimes, and they're not being fostered, and they're not being honed in on. And really making sure that every child has the ability to meet their full potential is really a big passion of mine.
Awesome. And as far as from my work and my sort of lens, meeting potential has everything to do with execution, because if we can't figure out how to execute, how to get the things done to reach our goals, if we have these executive function blocks, then we are not going to be able to reach that. So that transitions us into, we got two more questions before we really get into the meat of your work. How do you define executive function in one sentence?
I would say, how somebody, this is really over the top, like kind of just off the top, how somebody moves through the world in a productive way.
Awesome.
Possibly.
Cool. And then tell us more. When you unpack executive function for 2 or 3 minutes, what do you, you know, if you're speaking to a parent who's really never heard of it and they're like, what is this about? How would you define it with a little more depth?
Yes. So I, you know, often the metaphor you hear is kind of the control panel, or, you know, really your brain's control center. And often I'll use that. And often I will just say, you know, our executive functions are what allow us to do all the things all day you know, it, and it really is that big and that pervasive when we talk about the umbrella of executive functioning. You know, it is what allows a person to, you know, move through the world and do what they need to do in a semi-goal-directed fashion in order to be productive and to, you know, do the things that they want to do. So that bleeds into every area of life, right? I mean, it is what allows us to get up in the morning and decide where to go first. Where do we go when we stand up and get out of bed? You know, it helps us know when we're, you know, after we brush our teeth, what do we need to do next? It helps us to think about, you know, before we got out of bed, we were laying there maybe thinking about what we need to do today. And all of those things really with planning and organizing and having a, you know, a semi-orderly life all lend themselves to executive functioning.
Awesome. Thank you. That was perfect. And I really like how you said it's, it's kind of like all the things that are needed to do all the things, the yes. planning and organizing and all the things that you need to yes. do to do all the Oops. Things. All right, now let's dive deep and sort of help parents figure out if you're working with the family, how are you going to help, how do you help families apply your teachings? And obviously we don't have a ton of time. You're not working with these clients for weeks or months. But in this time, how can they start to learn about your approach so that they can start to apply some of your key topics? And one of the things Angela is going to talk about is really about day-to-day life and just normal day-to-day things and where executive function shows up. But what I'm going to do, Angela, is I'm going to ask you one big question, and then I'm going to break down the two parts of that big question in great depth in a moment. So the first big question, so what we're going to talk about is the problem that you see in your work with the families and what they struggle with and the solution. And when a family comes to you, maybe you're thinking of a family in your head right now that's come to you and they have, they're like your classic family that you work with and they come in with this problem and they're worried about their kid. What is the problem? What do they come to you saying, hey, we're struggling with this. Can you please help us? And then what is point B, Angela, when the family has gone through a transformation, they've applied a lot of strategies that you've taught them and everything, and they're finally at this place where they're at point B and things have really transformed for them and they can really breathe a sigh of relief. So how do you say, all right, here they are at point A, they've gone through a process and they get to point B? What, or maybe not even how you describe it, how do they describe it? Either way, how do you want to take that question?
Okay. So I would say when families come in, for the first part of your question, when families come in, it's often because the way that their child is behaving is bumping up against the expectations they had and what they believe how a child should be acting or behaving. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. So what their perception of what a child should do is not aligning with what is actually happening. And most always they've tried. They've been ineffective and their interventions haven't been successful. So by this point they're frustrated. And a lot of times, honestly, it feels like, here you go. Here's my kid. You know, tell me how to fix them. Tell me how, you know, here's my kid. How can I fix them? Or more so actually is fix them sometimes. Because we forget as parents often how big of a role we have. And mm-hmm. these are our kids, you know, they're still developing and we need to play a large role in their support. So that is often what brings them in. The child is struggling, usually in more than one context. So they're
And I'll ask you about the depth about that in a moment.
Okay.
We'll unpack that big time.
Okay. So likely struggling at home and at school or with peers and at school, more often than not, they're struggling in multiple areas. So the parent is being alerted to, okay, you know, there's something extra going on here. There's an additional variable that we may be dealing with here. So that is the first half as far as when parents come in. As far as when they leave, the hope is that they better understand their child. So for some reason in our culture, we think that people should just be able to raise humans without having any sort of education or preparation, which is just nuts. It's just nuts. I mean, sometimes it works out okay if, you know, our child's personality and temperament, if everything flows with the way we do things and, you know, sometimes, you know, it works, but for so many kids, they're just much more complex than that. They're so much more complex. And so no wonder families don't know where to turn and don't know how to support their child. Of course, we were never told this, you know, the big idea and the big, our cultural parenting, you know, pile of, you know, bull crap is that, you know, this is what kids should do and your kids should listen and you should have control over them and they should listen the first time and you should be able to control them all the time. And just, you know, really this idea that, you know, the parents are here and the kids are here and this is their role and this is yours. And we need some kids that are breaking that mold. We need strong, assertive, you know, bold kids that are strongly convicted. And, you know, these are the kids that are known as strong-willed. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that label. I know a lot of people don't like it. I think it's a great label to have a strong will. Yeah, it's not great when you're trying to figure out, you know, if you're a new parent and this is happening, it doesn't feel great at that point, but it is great and it will be great.
And when they're sort of at that point B and they're armed with some real clear understanding about their kid, then the strong will is a good thing. And when they're at that point B and you've taken them through and really helped them get to that point where they really have a good understanding of the kid, how does the parent feel and how does the kid feel at this point?
Well, the kid feels understood. The kid feels seen. The kid feels like they're valued. Somebody sees me. Somebody knows who I am. And that is the core, you know, of emotional health and mental health is, you know, I am valued. I am worth it. I have integrity. And that is what a child, when a parent, you know, is willing to dig in to better understand, okay, this kid is more complicated. I do need to proactively learn about my kid. That's an awesome thing. That is okay. Nobody, you know, comes into this as an expert. Even parenting experts aren't experts. You know, I was floundering my way, you know, for years trying to navigate my complex kid. So it's, you know, when parents are able to be humble and to dig in and say, okay, I want to meet my kid where they're at. I want to better understand them. Their kid, they will be able to connect with their child in a way that they have never been able to. And that connection is, I mean, it's the foundation for everything. It's a basic need for a child. And to be able to see the kid for who they are, you know, and not for their behaviors, right? We want to figure out what's going on underneath the behavior so we can get to the kid and we can enjoy the kid and we can connect with them and have an amazing close relationship that we always wanted. And that's what we did picture. And it was not in alignment with the dynamic possibly, you know, during the times of when we're caught in that stress cycle, but it is so possible. And so that at the end is hopefully where we're at. The kid is seen, the kid feels connected, the kid feels that their strengths and the way they go about doing things is valuable and is okay and they're okay. And the parents feel confident, right? I want parents to feel confident that at the end of the day, they did what they could, you know, to help their kid thrive in the world someday. So, you know, part of parenting is survival, just keeping them alive. But then as our kids get older, you know, it's our role. If nobody else is going to help them thrive if we don't and give them these life skills that they need. And it really does all start with connection and helping to support them wherever they're at, which is hopefully where the parent is at. is equipped with those skills at the end.
I really like that. Like listening to you, it reminds me, first of all, of attachment theory, which I think is a huge, huge concept throughout this whole thing. And I think that that's at the core of, for me, being able to empower a struggling adolescent. I usually work with middle, high school, and college students. For what I do professionally, like, I have to have a healthy, secure attachment with a kid. And as I'm working with a kid, I want their family to have greater connection. And what you're saying is essentially at point A, the kid feels disconnected from the parent feels disconnected from the kid, there's a lot of misunderstanding. And point B, there's connection. And I asked you how they would feel, and to feel connected is everything. It's one of the most important things, if not the most important thing in life, is to feel connected, mm-hmm. like you matter, like you're heard, mm-hmm. like you're seen, like you belong. So I think that's beautiful. I like how you put that.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
So let's keep, what we'll do for, we'll really dive in for the next several minutes in more into the problem. I want to unpack the problem so much that the parents watching can be like, oh, yep, that's me. I get it. I hear that. And then we'll dive into the solutions and how can we get to that point B. So what are some examples when someone, like a real life example, somebody who's come to you in the last couple of years and they come into you and they're saying, this is specifically what the behaviors look like. This is what I'm seeing at home. Can you think of someone?
Yes. I think the biggest one is not, do you want me to hone in on specific behaviors or really a specific client?
What do you want?
I think looking at the behaviors, I think then we can jump Let's into the kind of those myths and the day-to-day challenges that, you know, kids encounter. I think the biggest thing is not listening. We do not like it when our kids don't listen to us. Mm. Parents do not like it. It's very triggering to parents for several reasons. I think one of the main reasons being we live in a busy world. We live in a world that's too busy, I would argue. And I'm living in it too. I'm not pointing any fingers, but we're trying to do lots of things. We're trying to do too many things. And when we're trying to do too many things, and then we're trying to get our kid to do the things, and our kid's not listening, it does not go over well with us, because essentially we're going and we're living in our, basically our autopilot, mode, so to speak, when we're, you know, we're going through the day, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're looking at our to-do list. You know, we are literally our brain, the thinking part of our brain literally goes offline, and then we're back in our autopilot, our emotion brain, which kind of steers us through. And it's helping us survive, but it's not allowing us to be very conscious of what's going on around us.
Yeah, so, we're not conscious. We're not aware. We're not mindful at those moments. We're just, like you said, autopilot, robots.
Yes.
A lot of a lot more than we realize, and it's okay, but it causes problems.
Yes, definitely. There's a lot, there's room for, it's a great adaptive quality to have an implicit memory. You know what to do. Your brain, your body knows what to do next, but it doesn't always lend itself to conscious parenting. So I think that's a big one. Honestly, I think in our stressed world, we have very little tolerance for our kids to speak up, speak their mind, say, you know, no, I don't want to do that right now, or to struggle, because their kids and their brains are growing, and brand new. And so of course they're going to struggle, but we don't have time for those struggles. Like, do the thing and do it now when we ask you. And then we get triggered because we are in that emotion area of the brain. So then we're more prone to having an emotional response. So instead of, I don't want to go too far into this, but I think it's helpful for the audience. So, you know, if we respond to it quickly, okay, I might have to pause. I totally had a brain freeze. Sorry. It's fine. Totally fine.
All right, we're back on here. We just had a little executive function brain pause to reset. Our brains got off track here. So Angela, let's get back to with the when kids don't listen, what do parents say? My kid won't listen to me. And they, what do they say? How do their kids not listen?
Well, so what I was getting into was that when we're in that reactive part of the brain, we're much more likely to react from our emotions when our kids don't do what we want them to do or don't listen. So if we say, you need to go get your shoes on, it's time to go to school, go get your shoes on in your backpack. And our kid stays there. They keep playing with their Legos. They don't move. So we come again and we say, okay, go get your shoes on. I just told you, you need to do, you know, do your stuff. Go get your shoes on. Go get your backpack. Get out to the car. And they're not listening. Again, they're not moving, or they start moving slowly. So at that point, instead of when we're in this mode of living, instead of being able to stop, pause, and be conscious, as in take into account what's happening around us and what's happening with our child, we are going to react
to out of
our own emotions. Yes, which is parents being triggered. Yes. So instead of the better option A, which would be, okay, stopping, noticing, observing what you're seeing. You know, it looks like you're having a hard time, right? Looks like I've asked you a couple times and you're really playing with your Legos. You're focusing on it. You love doing your Legos. It's hard to be done. So then we're empathizing with the kid. We're just getting down on their level and we're trying
to attune
exactly. What's going on for them, right? Dialing into just what's going on for our child. And because only when we do that can we then help them. Only when we do that can we bridge to the next thing, helping support them to be able to follow through with the directive in whatever way that might look. It will often look different for our unique kids.
And when we're not doing that and we're triggered, what do we do instead of slowing down and whatever? What does it look like when the parent's like, okay, this kid needs to stop with the Legos and get in the car? What do they do when they're triggered? What does that look like?
This looks like the universal, you know, nagging. It looks like losing our temper. It looks like criticizing. It looks like, what's wrong with you? I asked you twice now to go get your shoes and you're still not doing it. You know, it looks like shaming a lot of the time. It looks like criticism and nagging, all of which are
don't feel connected, like you said before, to either party.
Yes, they don't feel connected, and therefore they're not going to work. They're going to be totally ineffective. And if a kid does comply with those, it's because they're shutting down emotionally. And our kiddos, our, you know, bright, strong, sensitive kiddos, are often not going to comply because they're not buying what we're selling, and they need, a lot of times they require more from us. They're saying, hey, I need to be seen. You know, hey, what about me? I'm here. I'm a human. I'm playing with my Legos and I love it. And I'm so intense about it. And I have such strong emotions and I'm really focused on it. So please, you know, be considerate of me. I'm a human being. So oftentimes, you know, they call us and challenge us to more, you know, to needing to level up, so to speak, in these ways. So,
stop you there? Because I really want to emphasize that concept that you just said. And that is that in a really positive way, when they're not doing what we're asking, they are communicating a need to us that often goes unseen. And you use the word invisible a lot, but like if we can pause and say, what's the need, and look at it and frame it in our own mind as, wow, this is actually an opportunity to unpack what they're trying to communicate to me. I think that's really a really key, neat concept.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that, you know, it's interesting because that is seemingly fairly simple, right? I mean, you think, okay, I can do that. I can stop. I can pause and I can think, what does my kid need? But holy cow,
that would
be the mother of all, easier said than done. So yes, there's enormous power in that, but it also is definitely an ongoing journey to be conscious and to be, you know, aware and attuned to what our child needs.
So my next question, and this is still unpacking the problem, and you've been talking about this, I'm just going to frame the question a little bit differently. What are some of the common blind spots that parents have when they come to you?
Well, I mean, at the most obvious, their blind spots are that their child is differently wired, possibly, that they think differently, they look at the world differently, they really literally have a different perception oftentimes of certain situations and dynamics. I think parents are often unaware of that dynamic at all, is the way that many kids are made, that inherently they came into the world hardwired to do things differently. So that is the biggest one. I think connection is a huge blind spot. I think very, very rarely do parents understand. It's funny because I talk a lot in my writing about, I did my thesis on attachment theory, and we hear a lot about attachment theory and connection in the younger years, right? In the birth to three, and how important it is. And a lot of us could even say, secure attachment or, avoidant attachment.
And I want you to break that down in a moment for people because a lot of people won't know what that is, and it's so important, but keep going, and then we'll circle. I'll remember to circle back to that.
Okay. So really, just looking at the attachment and how important it is, and that it's not just, there's all sorts of studies on the early years, and then people have this idea that it kind of drops off after toddlerhood or after preschool, and then all of a sudden, it doesn't become as important, this dynamic, this parent-child dynamic, and having a strong, close connection and attachment doesn't get a ton of focus, which is crazy because it remains a primary need for a child, in a human, as you mentioned before, throughout the lifespan. It's a prime, human connection is on the bottom of that pyramid of basic needs because it's the foundation, right? It's a basic need for kids. So I think that's a big blind spot for kids. And again, that, we can kind of loop back to the busyness thing with that too. Mm-hmm. A lot of kids aren't getting the connection that they need because of the busy world. And a lot of times that comes out, they communicate that need for connection through their behaviors.
So it's absurd to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What's the 2-minute version of what attachment theory is and why parents need to value it so much? Why it's important in my work and your work. It's just, if parents want their kid to be happy, healthy, successful human beings, we've got to invest a lot of energy in this thing called attachment theory. What the heck is that?
Yes. Yeah. So really it's looking at the dynamic between parent and child, and it's looking at how, some of the variables it looks at are how responsive a parent is to a child's needs. It looks at, how flexible they are. It looks at when they move toward their child and when their child's struggling, when they move away, all of these things. So some people have heard of, there's the classic studies, or maybe not, maybe it's just because I've been in the psychology world, so I feel like this is common knowledge, but with
stuff like that.
Yes, they videotaped, the moms and the kids, and they noticed how the babies would react and how moms would react if the babies would cry and the babies would struggle, how supportive they were, how the babies reacted to the parents' attempts to come intervene and help, and basically would then kind of quantify the attachment as at a really surface simple level, a healthy attachment or an avoidant attachment or an anxious attachment and an unhealthy attachment. So really it's just looking at the quality of the relationship and the dynamic between a parent and child.
It's the connection, right? It's like attachment theory, just to go back to that key word, is like, do we feel like a healthy connection with our spouse, with our child, with our friends, with our coworkers, or do we feel an unhealthy, insecure, anxious or avoidant attachment where we don't feel connected or we feel disconnected? So cool.
Yes.
Where was I? Okay. So I was asking about, some of the blind spots, and another way to phrase it, what blocks parents, what holds parents back from being able to transform the relationship or have tools to really support their kid in the way that they intend to? What are some of the blocks that keep them from getting it or finding solutions?
Yes. Just going to sketch these down really quick so I don't forget my last one. So I think the first one that popped into my mind was their own personal history, parents' own childhood and some of the issues that they experienced. Oftentimes, you know, things have changed a lot in recent decades in regards to raising humans and parenting. And really, you know, even for, you know, in our generation, a lot of these things just weren't, it wasn't valued to, you know, nurture your these qualities in your child, nurture well-being in your child, help them understand themselves and how they can interact in the world, their emotions, all that kind of stuff. And so the emotion piece, the emotional intelligence piece is huge with this and with parents' own histories. And that means their ability to navigate emotions, especially complicated emotions, in a healthy way. That means we know what we're feeling. We are able to acknowledge that, and then we can work through that in a positive, proactive way. Most of us, a lot of us, were not raised with any sort of emotional intelligence skills. A lot of us were told to quiet down if we're crying. You're okay. You know, when you're hurt, stop whining. You know, all of these things that are really communicating needs and communicating emotions.
Yeah.
So
and the
of
message
course,
is stuff it or don't feel it or.
Feelings are bad. Yep. Don't listen to yourself, you know, quiet that inner voice, quiet your, so definitely that plays a big role in, how parents are able to show up for their kids who are struggling with their emotions. Now, if parents cannot navigate through their own emotions, they're going to struggle helping their child when their child is struggling, and then they're getting triggered, right? That means they're going to that emotion place of the brain where their emotions are big. They're, you know, then kind of our thinking brain shutting down. We're saying and doing things that we regret and that we don't want to do because we're triggered. Mm-hmm. So that is the biggest one. And I see a lot of parents that are really blocked with that and, are unable to see that, you know, that they had an upbringing that might reflect, you know, a certain way on the situation now, or that are open to it and that say, oh yeah, you know, when I was raised, you know, I don't know what to do. I was hit. I was spanked. I was screamed at. So we don't know what to do. And we're turning to some negative tools and we don't want to, but we don't know how to stop because by that point things are very subconscious. So then we need to talk, you know, dig into that a little bit.
Angela, I think that's so important for you to bring up on this conference because this is for parents. And I know that this is a repeating theme as well. And I always say that, yeah, we all have some level of dysfunction in our families. We've mm-hmm. all got baggage and there's no mm-hmm. shame around it. There's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that. Mm-hmm. It just mm-hmm. is. So sure. I think yep. sometimes when you were saying that that's one of the biggest blocks, I think my opinion is that one of the reasons it's one of the biggest blocks is because it's so hard for us to say, yeah, I struggled with this or that, or my family was like this, because it then feels like there's mm-hmm. something wrong with mm-hmm. us or mm-hmm. we're bad or
yes.
families mm-hmm. are broken mm-hmm. or, you know, it's just like, no, we've all got it. We've all got yeah. junk. Like there can be a yeah. levity and a playfulness and an acknowledgement around that and a lightness around it where we can say, yeah. And there's also a lot of heaviness for a lot of families and a lot of sure. people watching right now who have had real big things happen in their past or in their family systems, even for multiple generations. But there's also a sense of, okay, we're human and it's okay. Let's mm-hmm. dive into this and we will be okay. And it's such a good model, I think, for kids to see us saying, I'm going to do self-development or self-growth or take challenges where I learn about myself with the phrase you use with emotional intelligence or this mm-hmm. this whole world that we tend to have grown up thinking was bad or inappropriate or something. Anyhow, I yeah. did not mean to get off track with you, but just I really think you're right, it is such a big block to getting the help that they want.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. It makes me think of the Dan Siegel quote, a child's, I'm probably going to butcher it a little bit, but essentially the biggest predictor of a child's well-being is a parent's self-understanding. Mm. I think that's a really powerful quote because until we're able to get humble and reflect on our own, you know, hold ourselves accountable for our own behavior and actions, and we're going to not be able to effectively guide our child with that. So jumping back to the other two blocks, I'd say the other block would be, you need to fix this is my child's problem and not mine. So that might lend itself a little bit to resist kind of the idea of resistance.
Impact, not acknowledging the impact that their words or body language or
behaviors
have, that the parents' words and behaviors have.
Yes. And I think oftentimes that can bleed a little bit into the third thing that popped to mind, which was parents' own challenges with executive functioning. That is something you see a lot, because executive functioning issues run in families. It's a biological deal. And so often that makes things all the more complicated. And, you know, parents just have additional variables to navigate to. They're trying to, you know, keep themselves on track, and and they also are struggling with the same things, which makes us bump into our kid a lot more, right? And then when our kid is the same as us, and we look at our kid and we see our own struggles, that is not a friend of our subconscious either. And then we get, you know, triggered by that. So we don't like that at all. And often our kids' strong emotions, emotion regulation is a huge, I would say, for me personally, in our family, I would say that is the biggest variable with executive functioning. I think it gets addressed the least in the literature. But as far as how it's affected our family, I would say emotion regulation is a huge part of
that. What is emotional regulation, Angela?
So that is our ability to essentially manage our emotions in a healthy, you know, goal-directed way. So in order to, you know, get through school, we need to be able to cope, and we need to be able to self-soothe when our teacher says we can't sit up in the front desk without having a total meltdown and crying. And, we need to be able to both, you know, behaviorally, with the skills that we get as we grow, and also the even bigger part, which is how we are hardwired, because this is part of executive functioning. Some kids will inherently struggle much more. Those areas of the brain are delayed, and they struggle much more with emotion regulation. They will have a much lesser capacity to self-soothe, to be aware of their emotions. And then when it's harder to be aware of our emotions, then we can't work through our emotions. We don't know how to cope. So kids who have executive functioning challenges will very, very often struggle with regulating, managing in a healthy way, their emotions. And that really affects families in a big way. And tying it back into that third block, you know, when kids are struggling with their emotions, that triggers parents. And then the parents are struggling with their emotions. They're losing their temper because the kid's losing their temper. And that, then you just get this big ball of, you know, emotional flame, this explosion where it was a flame with the kid. And a lot of times parents aren't aware of that. They aren't able to see their role in it. And they're not able to see that it is a real challenge for them, because they may have some of these same challenges as their child.
What about the parent that's watching right now that's thinking, I never blow up, I never get angry, I don't have any issues regulating emotion? Because I think anger, like me growing up, like it was, there was this message, you should not show anger, or you should not feel angry. Anger is bad. What about, because I think a lot of people, so what about parents who are like, I don't get angry, I don't blow up at my kid?
I don't even know what I don't think that parent is out there. So I don't know what I would say. I mean, honestly, we're all
Well, the human. One who believes that they don't
out there. We all have our reptilian brain, so we all feel emotions and we all get angry. For the ones that don't, I'd say that's fantastic, because I mean, it's healthy to get angry. Sometimes I'd be scared that you were a robot if you didn't.
We all do, but some of us suppress it or don't.
Sure.
I didn't recognize for example, my anger until I did a lot of work on myself. And then for me, as a teen, for example, I was very depressed. And when I finally got older and started really looking at my emotional world, I started understanding that my quote depression, the things that I was depressed about, like I was pissed. I was angry about those things. Like I had, and I just didn't want to call it that, but I don't want to get off track. But the point is that I think I want parents to walk away being like, wow, okay, maybe I have some, as you said, emotional stuff that I'm not aware of. And if they can at least, how do we become more aware of this?
Yes, yes. So yeah, every parent, every human will, it's healthy to be angry, but we also need to learn how to manage it in healthy ways. So if it's coming out in a destructive way, and if it is going to be, a toxic way that's shaming to the child, that's fear-based, that's scary to the child, and you're not able to control it, then, you know, we have some work to do, definitely. And I would argue that that's a lot of parents. We, like you said, a lot of people grew up with that. Don't get angry. Be quiet. You're fine. You know, very well-meaning, right? We want our kids to be tough and resilient. And I still want my kids to be tough and resilient. But now we're dialed into healthy ways to do that, that don't spiral into depression and anxiety for 80% of the population or, you know, whatever it is. It's nuts. So,
and with the words that you used before to help people move through it and not ignore it and say, oh, you don't feel this way, stop feeling that way, but to move through it. That's the healthy path.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Definitely. So, yeah. So I think that's what I would say to that. It's just having that self-awareness of how is this coming out? How are my emotions impacting my child? Certainly it's good for parents to the best thing parents can do to help their kids manage their emotions is to manage their own in a healthy way and model that for the child.
Can you say that again, please?
The best way for parents to help a child learn to regulate and manage their emotions in healthy ways is to make sure that they are managing their own emotions and giving the kids lots of good examples, lots of good modeling of what to do, of when, what they're feeling, when, you know, when they're feeling it, verbalizing this. Really, it feels silly. It's kind of a different thing, but once you get in the habit of it, you know, saying how we feel and then coping with it in a healthy way, taking a minute, you know, doing what you need to do, taking a breath. Those are huge things because that shows the kid, you know, this is what I do. And if we can't do it as adults whose brains are fully developed, our kids don't stand, you know, any chance of being able to do it as children and then having the additional layer of executive functioning challenges. It's just not going to happen. So we have to, it's uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable for me, but when all of a sudden the spotlight turns on the parent and it's okay, you really do need to look at yourself, and that is going to be the best teacher for your child.
I'm completely in agreement. Completely. I talk a lot about that as one of the best things that you can do is your own. I just use the words, your own deep inner work.
Yep.
All right, let's dive super deep into solutions now. I mean, I know we've been weaving in and out of them with the unpacking the problem, but let's unpack the solution a little bit more. How do you know, or how does the family know? They've come and they've been working with you for a while, and they're like, you know what? We're good. We're in such a good place. How do they know that they've gotten to that point B? What's the evidence, or what do they see, or how do they feel?
Well, I'd say life just feels lighter, right? When parents are struggling, I think a lot of the families listening today, I'd venture to guess that life just feels heavy a lot of the time. It feels harder than it needs to. And it doesn't have to be that way. So I think when parents realize they feel confident that they can dial into their child's needs, they know how to support their needs, they're able to be more conscious to, okay, this is what's happening. You know, it's the kid is often doing better in school. It's a long process. It really is. It is usually, I would say, usually kiddos with these types of challenges will be with me for 1 to 3 years, I'd say. So really to create meaningful change in those systems, and that's not always going to be the case, but you know, consistency is good for kids, and for lots of kids, it takes a while for those changes to take, you know, for school and home to really materialize, for parents to really feel confident, to really get it, for a kid to then, you know, feel positive and that their needs are being met and then respond better. Kids are going to have an easier time, and their executive functioning is going to improve. Of course, the challenges are still going to be there, mm-hmm. but they will be less mm-hmm. when they are being adequately supported and attuned to and connected to, and they're being approached from a different angle. Those things will loosen up, and there will be more room for them to rise to the occasion. So I would say, yeah, just overall things just don't feel so stressful all the time. Mm-hmm.
And can you describe what process or steps you've taken people through? Is it a step-by-step or is it a process?
That would be tricky to do because it's really, yeah, it's pretty different based on each child and where they're at and what we need to do as far as, you know, with all kids, it's always the framework of emotional intelligence. So they are hearing oftentimes for the first time when they come in to my office to tell someone how they feel. And most of the time kids say good. And then I say, that's not an emotion word. You know, let's learn some words. There's all sorts of different really cool descriptive words for our emotions. You'd be surprised at, you know, maybe you think you're feeling this and then you also realize, oh yeah, and I'm feeling that and that, and there's primary emotions and secondary emotions. And then being asked to, you know, self-reflect and say how they're feeling is pretty overwhelming for a lot of kids when we're not used to this. We're not used to bringing these things to light. Mm-hmm. So that's always the main thread in the foundation is just, you know, connecting with the child and trying to understand where they're at, what their struggles are.
So what you're saying is a big part of your process is helping them develop this sort of emotional intelligence and emotional IQ, where they have words to describe emotions. They're able to really feel emotions, know what they're feeling, just get in tune with that. Parents are able to talk to their kids about that and have dialogue on a different level. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely.
How do you get them there? How does somebody who's watching now, like, are there things that they can read or people you'd recommend they look at or models you'd like, how does the person right now start to go down the rabbit hole of how do we get there?
Yeah. Well, I'd recommend that they read a lot of my writing on emotional intelligence. Obviously.
We will link to that on your page too.
Yep. So okay.
You can click the link right there.
Perfect. I have a number of good resources on that. I also have a resource for families that's emotional intelligence, bundle, which is really, you know, a visual kids with, you know, teaching emotional intelligence. I'm going to say EQ from now on, so I don't have to keep saying emotional intelligence. Teaching EQ to kids has to be visual because kids are visual learners, or visual processors, especially when they're overwhelmed. They need that concrete visual. So it's, you know, a sheet of emotions, faces, and also emotions flashcards. It's printable stuff. So parents can just get it and print it out. And then there's a guide for parents on emotional intelligence, why it's so significant and important. And there's coping strategies as well, for each emotion and a mindfulness strategy, for each. So that's a good starting place for a younger child, you know, like 2 to 10, I'd say. But any sort of resource like that, you know, where they have a great visual with different emotions, a framework that is fairly common in schools that I love, that we've used at home a lot, is the zones of regulation. That is a fantastic way that breaks down in a really simple form for kids, you know, different emotions, and also really links to the physiological piece of emotional regulation. So how our feelings impact our body, what kind of...
I'm glad you said that. Can you tell us what that means? What is the physiological part of emotional regulation?
Sure. So our emotions are, you know, we have emotions on a cellular level. They are, you know, actual chemical reactions happening in the brain, and they cause reactions, physiological reactions in our body. So, you know, a big part of helping kids learn how to manage their emotions is helping them understand what I often refer to as our body's anger buttons, our body's anger warning signals. So what do we notice? Tuning in and trying to observe what we notice in our body, what sensations and things physically are happening in our bodies at the times when we're very emotional.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we are so disconnected from that as a culture. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know about parents watching this, but it took me years to be able to attune to what's going, like I'd have a thought, I would, you know, respond to it and try to make sense of my own story. But that you have a thought and there's a feeling, there's something going on that's a response to that. And getting in touch with that has been a game changer for me, and is absolutely a huge part of my work with kids. So I'm really, really glad you brought that up too. So they go and and parents should learn about the physiological part, the emotional intelligence stuff. A lot of the resources we'll link to and.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the zones of regulation is great, because it will connect a lot of that stuff. So it breaks it down into, you know, you can print out all sorts of different zones, visuals, but breaks it down into four different zones. So instead of asking a child, especially a smaller child, to look at this list of tons of emotions and process all this information, do all the self-reflection that most don't have the cognitive capacity to do until they're, you know, 9 or 10, you're giving them this framework of, you know, with it follows a stoplight, except for the blue. So we have green is where we want to be. Green means go. We're happy. We're calm. We're focused. Yellow is we need to slow down. We might be a little hyper. We might be a little anxious, a little frustrated. So there's a bunch of different emotions in each zone. But it really helps kids look at it and get a feel for, oh yeah, I am just feeling yellow. I'm feeling fast. I'm too fast. I'm wiggly. I'm silly. I need to slow down. Red being, you know, angry. I'm exploding. I've lost control. I need to stop. And then blue is we're moving too slow. We're sick, we're bored, we're tired, whatever it might be. So that is a brilliant way. And I give it to all my families right away, because it really helps kids internalize it much quicker and easier than all the talking and all of the, all different visuals. It integrates everything into one.
I like that. I think that's a really valuable tool. I have a lot of families who will write and ask, because I don't usually work with younger kids, but how do we start working with executive function younger ages? And obviously you're talking about emotional regulation, which is part of executive function, but to get that is such a great concrete way. You don't even have to know you're developing emotional regulation and executive function through doing it. Just do it. Like, that is planting a really important seed of being able to think about and dialogue about this abstract world of emotion. But learning to do that oftentimes, we learn it as adults way down the line from some horrific experiences that we've had. And we're like, oh, how do I, you know, and then we finally start to dive into this world. Awesome. I love that. Do you want to say more about that one, or should I move on?
I think that one is probably good. And then any other resources that I think of, we can link on the page.
Okay.
Cause I am thinking of a really great, book on physical sensations with younger kids, helping them to know how, you know, what changes are happening in their bodies and stuff. So yeah, I'd say we can just add those things on. Definitely.
And we'll start wrapping up in a moment, but I had started asking about the process or steps, and you talked a lot about teaching the emotional stuff. Are there other core concepts that you're always going back to, or steps or processes that they need to know in order to help their child?
Well, I'm trying to think, because the things that I do might be a little bit beyond the scope of the time scope for today. But the other thing that I'm pretty much always doing with these kiddos is cognitive behavioral therapy. So that is, I mean, breaking it down as simply as possible for parents. It's actually, you mentioned this before, our thoughts. you know, lead to our feelings, and our feelings lead to actions. And how can we help kids dial into their thinking, their patterns of thinking? A lot of us have negative thinking patterns. So that is a really big one where, you know, biologically we come into the world with a negativity bias where our brain wants to survive. And our emotion brain is always scanning, our, you know, this is survival bias. It's scanning for danger. It's scanning for what could go wrong. And, because of that, you know, it's easy to be negative. And we were talking about this before, you know, in terms of it's easy to be negative with our kids because of that as well, and why it's harder for us to unearth their strengths oftentimes. So definitely looking at the thinking patterns and reframing some of those negative thoughts and worries and things that build and snowball and lead to, you know, behaviors, challenging behaviors.
Yeah. So that we're not ruled by them. We can experience them, but it's not just dictating our life anymore.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And another thing that I'd say is definitely always a mainstay is helping kids to discover their strengths, helping build confidence. And parents can do this by just being intentional about looking for strengths. And as we mentioned in the beginning, this is a huge, huge game changer that has far-reaching implications when we can stop our own negativity bias, stop our own brain scanning, right? As parents, we notice the negative stuff. I was just talking about this with my husband the other day, and he was mentioning to me a few really great things that our kiddos did or said. And I said, did you mention it to them? And he's like, no, you know, and it's like, Oh yeah. Like we got to say these things to them. Like we have to, and it was good. The first step was noticing it and bringing it to light with us because we don't even notice those things sometimes because we're in that mode of go, go, go. And so, oh, nope, don't do that. No, stop. We're in crisis control and we're the behavior police. And we just don't stop to take in the positive things, the great things, the quirky things, the unique things. We, you know, if we don't give ourselves that time and we don't have that intention to really look at that, look at our child through that lens of positivity and strength, you know, we're going to miss those things. And that's such a big thing parents can do. I will help, you know, parents learn how they can do that and have some concrete activities they can do and things. But overall, you know, parents are, it's just a matter of knowing and being aware. Oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, it's a surprise for most parents. Yeah. I need to spend time on this. My kid doesn't just know these things. They don't know. Along with not being able to say their emotions, most kids who come into my office can't tell me more than two things about who they are and what it means to be them. Some of them can say strengths. A lot of them will start talking about how they look and I have blue eyes, and but they don't hear a lot about what's on the inside and what, you know, really for parents to reflect back to what they see to their child, their strengths, their, you know, unique talents, their passions, their, you know, their positive behaviors, just to notice those and say them back, reflect that back. That is the biggest thing they can do to build their child's confidence, because otherwise, you know, we're just noticing the negative. We're not noticing the positive. We're not putting energy into that. And we need to stop and we need to be intentional about it. And we need to put energy into the positive, right? Because what we put energy into grows. So the big part of getting out of that vortex of negativity is focusing on the positive and noticing these things every single day and forcing yourself to, no matter how hard it is, no matter how challenging the behaviors are. I know it's not easy. Sometimes it's really not easy because it is stressful. These behaviors that families deal with can be extraordinarily stressful. But we got to force ourselves to, we got to change our brain, I know you talk about that with clients and in your writing, but you know, as parents, we can change our brains by, you know, intentionally refocusing our thinking. We create new neural pathways by being, you know, thinking about calling to mind the positive things with our kids and start new habits for us, and it will shift things organically. It really will start to shift things.
And two more things to wrap up. You ready?
Yes.
Thank you so much, by the way. This has been...
Oh, yeah.
I just am very aligned, and it's really nice to hear your phrasing for everything and your insights. And so people are watching. What specific actions can they take this week to get started with some of your key concepts?
Okay. What specific actions? Let's see. I would say they can, I'm trying to boil it down to maybe like two or three solid takeaways, because I tend to give a ton, which feels overwhelming to me when I'm taking a resource in. So let's boil it down a little bit. I would say the first thing is a concept that we kind of threaded through the whole time, and that was this idea of tuning into what's going on with our child. What is our child's need under their behavior? So in order to do that, we need to, you know, be intentional about it, and then we need to be able to stop in the moment. We need to stop when it's super hard for our brain to stop. Our brain doesn't want us to stop. We're like a train that, you know, is ready to go off the tracks. We're getting into our motion brain. We need to stop, and we need to say, you know, this is not an emergency. You know, what is going on with my child? And tune into them at that moment. Disengage.
So this week, practice pausing and tuning in and saying, whoa, what's going on right now with my child?
Yes. Okay. Yep. Just getting curious. So these behaviors have been happening for so long. We get stuck in patterns. We get stuck in our own reaction. So just trying to flip the script a little bit, trying to step back and get curious. What's happening for them? Doesn't mean, you know, they have to know. Oftentimes they won't know. It takes a little more digging and a little more work, but you'll get to know your child and you'll get to see these things. But just what's going on for them? Just getting curious. What's happening for them?
Okay.
There's something going on. It's invisible, but I am going to trust that there is something going on, and I'm going to trust that, you know, my kid, you know, is having these invisible challenges, and not go with my assumptions anymore. Because of what we can't see, we assume, and it makes it much more challenging for these kids who have, and you know, unseen challenges to get support. Nobody can see these things. Therefore we say, oh, they don't exist. No, they do exist. We need to get that knowledge so that we know and believe and can buy in that, you know, this is happening on a brain-based physiological level. These challenges absolutely do exist. And so now how am I going to, you know, get curious about this need so then I can partner with them? So that would be the first thing, is stopping and getting curious. The second thing I would say is learning to, as parents, we want to be in control. And as humans, we want to be in control, right? It feels yucky. We like the illusion that we're in control of everything in our life. And oftentimes kids are our first, are like a real big wake-up call. Like, whoa, we cannot control everything. And also, a lot of times it's, you know, kids who struggle with executive functioning who are going to say, no, you can't control me. I'm here. I want to be seen. I want to be heard. I want to be validated. I have something to say, and I believe very strongly in it. And, you know, this is part of their personality. They're not choosing to, you know, to dig in. This is who they are. These are, you know, the kids who are going to, you know, do big, scary, awesome things in the world because they have the guts to do it. And they're right now having the guts to say, no, I don't want to do this. So collaborating with the child is the game changer.
So rather than dictating or controlling, shift the
brain. Yes. We want to be dictators as parents. We don't say we want to be, but we act like we want to be a lot of the time. And we want our kids to listen to us right away. We want them to do what we say. That's not who we want them to be out in the world, right? We want them to stand up, to have their own strong voice, to have their own opinion, to know how to express themselves. So our kids are not going to have these skills to do that. They have these strengths inherently. But if they're not, practiced and honed in on, they're not going to be able to use them out in the world the way that they're supposed to. That's why they're here. So what parents can do is they can start giving their kid an outlet for some of these skills. And that happens with, when their kid's not listening right away, it's getting curious. Okay, what's going on? I know that what I see at surface level is reflecting a need that we cannot see. So what's going on? And then the second step is, how can I collaborate with them? How can we figure out how to do this differently? How can we figure out how to do this better? So instead of us coming with this unilateral, this isn't working, your TV is gone, you're not doing anything, whatever, consequences imposed. Number one, it doesn't teach the kid any skills for next time. It does not teach them how they reacted may have been inappropriate or disrespectful. It does not give them the skills to handle the behavior next time. So it doesn't give them the why, the motivation to change their behavior, or the skills that they need. They need to be able to say, in a respectful way, hey, hold on one second. I'm really enjoying this. Is there any way I could have one more minute, Mom? And, if not, how they can respond in a better way. But that's what happens with collaborating. Collaborating is when we respect our child. We see them for the amazing person that they are, for a human being, that they have something valuable to offer the world. And so we're going to sit down and we're going to ask them what they think. We're going to ask them that's really hard. It seems like it's hard every morning when after you watch TV, you're watching TV and it's only 20 minutes, but then I ask you to turn it off when it's time to go get your shoes and backpack on and you don't listen. And every day it's the struggle and this just isn't working. And I'm sure it's stressful for you too, huh? Just listening. Parents.
So bringing them into the process. It's two-way. There's connection. There's movement. And that takes time to build. So parents, starting that this week, it's not like it's, these things really are a long practice. And I talk a lot about buy-in and ownership, and that sounds a lot very similar to the collaboration stuff. Do you talk about, does buy-in and ownership go with collaboration in your mind?
Definitely, because these kids aren't gonna buy into what we're selling. They have to. These are kids that are, they came into the world being self-driven, and we want to nurture them. We all want our kids to be self-driven, right? We don't want them to just be minions that go off and do whatever we tell them to do, because then they're gonna be in hot water when they're 18 or whatever. We want them to think critically about, the way I handled that wasn't very respectful to Mom, and this is really hard. I am struggling getting off my electronics. And it's not fun. These are things they probably haven't thought about before until a grown-up asks them. We don't ask our kids what they think, and we don't ask our kids to reflect on their own internal experiences. That's
one of the things I talk a lot about is this question, what do you think? That's one of the biggest tools that I give to parents, probably one of the top five, is asking their kid, what do you think? Not what do you think, but real genuinely, what do you think? Can I do this? I don't know. What do you think? Tell me why, So this week parents can really work on collaboration and work on pausing and attuning and saying what's going on in their experience right now. Whoa, let's put the brakes on. And then, okay, let's collaborate, bring them into this process and start that. So you would say those are two of the biggies?
I would. And even if it's just a conversation, even if the conversation goes haywire, it's fine. It's a start. You can learn to kind of come up with, a different framework, and one that's fantastic that I'm hoping in the fall to become trained on is the collaborative problem solving. Ross Green's model is a great one to use. You let your kids state how they're thinking and feeling. You tell them your thoughts, and then you figure out how to compromise and you try different things and you keep trying, because with these kids, you need to be flexible. You'll always need to revisit. New things will work. Parents are so frustrated. They say this worked for a week and then it stopped. And I say, yeah, I'll keep it around because you can try it again in a few months. And, but you always have to be reevaluating. But definitely, it's just a start. Just that shift in thinking of, this kid has stuff to say. They're smart. They're bright. I want to hear what they have to say. Let's let's, you know, call them to think about their role in the situation. Let's help them step up and take responsibility. We take responsibility for them when we yip and nag and give them a consequence and send them away. Let them, you know, step up and let them think about it and take responsibility. And then the last thing I would say, which is probably the simplest one, and one that can be done every day, a really small win every day, is just noticing one strength and just saying it out loud. If it's to yourself, if it's to your, you know, a partner or your child, to just notice one awesome thing about your kid, and you'll start to do it more and more if you do that.
And that's super concrete. That's such an easy one, or a hard one, but it really is. I talk about sincere compliments all the time. Just notice something sincere and say it. Like, all right, Angela, last question. Mm-hmm. From your heart to theirs, the people that are watching right now, mm-hmm. what is the most important takeaway you hope that they leave with right now?
Oh, this is hard to pick one thing, Seth. I would say the most important thing they walk away with is your kid is awesome. Your kid is amazing. They have strengths and gifts and things that are completely uniquely theirs. And once you can see that, you may not see that right now. And it's hard to see because parents often can't see it. They come in when they can't see it. And it's hard. So it feels hard. It feels hard for the parent. It feels hard for the child. You have an awesome kid. The behavior is just behavior. That is not your child. Their behavior is not them. They are a person. They have an identity. They are a human being under those behaviors. And once, you know, you can hone in on that, dig into that, see who they are, and enjoy them, they will thrive.
That was beautiful. That made me smile really big.
Oh, awesome. Good. Good. Yes.
All right, Angela, thank you so much. You all can click right here to learn more about Angela, and I hope you guys got a lot out of this session, and we will be seeing you soon, and I hope that you go take action right now. Take care.